My daddy has lots of books, and he likes to read books. And he interviews authors at KAZI. You are now going to listen to KAZI Book Review with Hopeton Hay.
In Matthew Petway's book, Cuban Literature in the Age of Black Insurrection, he reveals how Juan Francisco Manzano and Gabriel de la Concepcion Valdez used poetry to transform early Cuban literature into an instrument of black liberation from the 1820s to the 1840s. In 1844, Manzano and Valdez, who was known by the pen name Plácido, were arrested and charged with aiding and abetting a conspiracy to abolish slavery and depose the regime. Matthew Petway is an assistant professor of Spanish who focuses on Spanish language, Latin American literature, and Afro-Caribbean studies at the University of South Alabama. Matthew Petway, welcome to KZI Book Review.
I'm very happy to be here, Hopeton. Thank you for the invite.
Matthew, with the tumultuous times that we're living in and the challenges to democracy, I thought your book, Cuban Literature in the Age of Black Insurrection, I think history is full of lessons that even today in 2020, there's much we can learn from the resistance from the past, and specifically the Cuban poets Juan Francisco Manzano and Gabriel Concepcion Valdez. So they lived in the 19th century. They were tried for treason, basically, by the Cuban authorities. And they were writing subversive and anti-slavery poetry in the early to mid 1800s. So let's start off with you giving a short bios on them, and then if you could read some of their subversive poetry.
Absolutely. Once again, Hopeton, it's an honor to be here. I teach at the University of South Alabama, where a lot of my work deals with the Hispanophone Caribbean. And I came across Manzano and Plácido in graduate school. What really struck me about both authors were the fact that from a distance, they appear to be assimilationists. They appear to be fully assimilated to a Spanish Catholic, not only the religion, but the culture. But at a closer examination, one begins to realize that what appears sometimes to be Catholic or typical European literary trope is actually a reference to some sort of African Caribbean belief or an Afro-Caribbean religious practice. And so Manzano, I like to compare with Douglas, you know, for heuristic purposes, because he's the only author of a Spanish-American slave narrative or emancipation narrative that we have. And so Manzano was born in 1797 and he dies in 1853. He produces his autobiography between 1834 and 1835 or 1836. 1836 is when he's actually freed. He produces the slave narrative because it's requested by the most prominent humanist in his society at the time, the Cuban society, and that was Domingo Belmonte, who was also a slaveholder, who was most interested in stopping the slave trade to Cuba because he was afraid that Cuba would become a revolutionary black state as Haiti had before, between 1791 and 1804 in Manzano's infancy. So Manzano was a poet first. He publishes his first piece in 1821. His collection of poetry is published, really is the first we have in Cuba of a collection of poetry, even before some of the more famous or some of the white writers. His contemporary Plácido was born in 1809 while he's still a child himself. And they don't meet until somewhere around 1839 or 1840. There's a debate about the exact year because when both poets, as you correctly said, are accused of conspiring against the state or being enemies of the state, they quibble about when they met each other and they quibble about the nature of their relationship. But Plácido, I like to think of as a Martin Delaney figure because he was a free man of African descent. He was considered a mulatto because his mother was person of mixed race. His mother was from Burgos, Spain, northern Spain. His dad was considered an African descendant of mixed race. Plácido himself was said to be al parecer blanco when he was born, or white in appearance. And that I say that in part because the color politics and a place like Havana and a place like Matanzas in the 1800s might be compared to the color politics in a place like New Orleans, perhaps even here in Mobile during that same time period in Charleston. South Carolina. So anyway, Plácido did not publish a narrative about his life, but he became the most prolific poet of his time. He published his first in 1834. And he also, like Manzano, uses a combination of biblical imagery, neoclassical references. So throw in Venus appears in one of Manzano's poems. Plácido talks about the god of war, Mars, the Roman god of war, another one of his poems. Then you also have references to what appear to be folk culture, which is actually many times African-descended religious culture. And then they both also use these images. They use Catholic religious images as well, and they use them in the interests of Black power. So that's a quick introduction.
All right, so let's hear from the poets.
Sure, absolutely. Let me read first from Juan Francisco Manzano's poem, A Dream for My Second Brother, in Spanish, Un Sueño a Mi Segundo Hermano, published in 1838, after he's emancipated. And then I'll read from Plácido's poem, to the Lady, to the Virgin of the Rosary. Sometimes the Virgin Mary is also referred to as Our Lady of the Rosary. But A la Virgen del Rosario, or To the Virgin of the Rosary, which was published 2 years prior to Manzano's poem in 1836. And then maybe we can talk a little bit more about the politics of both. So I am reading now from chapter 4 of the book, Present but Unseen, African Caribbean Spirituality in Juan Francisco Manzano. And would you like me to read in English alone, English translation alone?
Just the English.
Just the English, okay. So I'll set this poem up briefly. What Manzano is doing in this particular poem is he has written a poem dedicated to his brother while Manzano was on the slave plantation, or the slave labor camp, as we might also refer to it. His mother not so much admonishes him, but charges him to free himself with the inheritance she has provided him. And then once he's done that, to put the family back together and to become a father to his siblings. Those are her exact words. Manzano's not quite able to free himself because he loses that inheritance, but he does eventually escape to Havana. And after writing his slave narrative at the behest of Domingo del Monte, this wealthy humanist and slaveholder, he does acquire his freedom. So this poem is significant because I read it as an effort by Manzano to reconstitute the African descended family that's been torn asunder by the evil of white supremacy and the evil of racialized slavery. So he starts the poem out in reference to his brother, and then I'll read, picking up and a couple of stanzas in, quote, confused and aggrieved, burdened by a thousand woes, I search for solitude, fleeing from man toward the nearby wilderness where Quintana's heel adorns and dominates the inner spaces. I came to a forest, a refuge I frequent, to quarrel with myself and secretly lament. Whether from fatigue or lack of sleep, I close my eyes for a sweet and pleasant dream. Having thus surrendered, bound in a snare, after a while, on my back I feel, made of magnificent feathers, two wings that I contemplate, precious and painted, a thousand beautiful hues. I move them a thousand times, perplexed in admiration, unable to comprehend the cause of this effect. Having seen so much from the air, I eagerly looked for the center of the earth to land from my flight. I gather my feathers, I slightly tilt my chest, and turning in circles, I come down again in a well-aimed descent into the heart of Matanzas, from where I gaze on that terrible place. There lie resting the miserable remains of our parents who gave us our first being. And that's from pages 158 through 160 in my book, Juan Francisco Manzano, a poem for A Dream for My Second Brother. I'd like to discuss that briefly, if you don't mind, before reading Plácido.
Well, I do want to add one thing, which is in light of the current situation, and we're recording this interview on October 24th, 2020. And so Manzano is his brother's keeper, unlike 50 Cent. So we have 50 Cent, the rapper, who's saying all he cares about is having lower taxes.
Yeah, we have a situation where it's very easy for us as African Americans to become, you know, very well adjusted to a maladjusted system, to accept essentially the logics of capitalism and to say, it's about me, I'm gonna get mine. And when we do that, not only are we not thinking about the broader community, but we're not thinking about African descended people around the world, and we're negating the historical experiences. So Monsanto does answer the question that Cain asked, right? In the book of Genesis, he is his brother's keeper. And so he dedicates this poem to him in order to go back and rescue him. I would add that from the standpoint of one of the things, I'll say this before, I want to explain the poem a little bit to the readers, but one of the things that I argue we can look to as we traverse this moment where we're resisting a resurgent and fierce white supremacist state, right, is that we can look to African knowledge systems, that we can study them to find what might be useful, what might help us as we rebuild, right? Hopefully be able to rebuild from the ashes of, you know, what is a very racist society. One of the things that Monsanto is drawing on is he's drawing on a West Central African idea of the dream state. So if anyone thinks about their grandmother or their mother talking about, hey, I had a dream about your cousin, or I had a dream about you, or your father appeared to me in a dream, we need to talk to such and such. This is the same type of idea, right? Not only is the subconscious working here from a scientific standpoint, but you have an African theory of dreams where the notion is that messages can be sent through dreams, voiceless communication can appear, and that certain individuals in the Bakongo tradition are particularly endowed with the ability to interpret dreams. They're particularly sensitive individuals, like a poet, right? Like Monsanto. So I read this as his parents sending him a message, because both of them had passed on or had transitioned by the time he wrote this. But the dream state also allows him space to do things he would not typically be able to do in literature. So he could get away, right, with this and the censorship. He could get away with this type of poem. The other thing that he does is that he focuses on the sacred mortal remains of his parents. And in so doing, he's also evoking that West Central African tradition where the sacred wilderness and the cemetery are conceptual equivalents. So he's going to the graveyard, essentially, and he's speaking to the ancestors. He's landing in the center of the earth.
Now, in America, we have not sort of accepted that African-based spirituality, which gives reverence to the ancestors, as they have in the Caribbean countries like Haiti and Cuba. Am I correct?
That's right. That's right. In the United States, typically African-inspired spirituality, as I refer to in the book, as Tadao Choa refers to it in his work as well, is considered to be something outside of the norm, something that's harmful, and it's often even associated with the notion of...
It's demonized.
The notion of the satanic. That's what I was going to say. And that's what the Spanish Catholics did as well from the very beginning. But what's more true is that the devil did not exist conceptually in traditional African spiritual systems. There's no such entity as the devil. You had good and evil coexisting, understood to coexist within human beings and understood to coexist within communities. And individuals or persons within community were then charged with the responsibility to use the power of good to improve the conditions of their communities. But the use of power to do ill was also recognized and often criminalized in African societies. It was often criminalized in African societies, and there were penalties to pay if one used what is often called, the Catholic Church called, brujería, witchcraft, right? And so both Judeo-Christian traditions and West Central African, the Bakongo tradition in this case, and the Yoruba tradition in what is today Nigeria and other parts of West Africa, acknowledge good and evil. But it's the African traditional systems, the Yoruba and the Bakongo, that say, look, they coexist in the same space. No one is completely good, no one is completely evil. And the question is, will you develop your ethical character so that you can use power for good? Power in and of itself is not wrong. It's not bad. It's a question of the use of that power. And I believe Monsanto was trying to get his hands on that power so that he can use it to free his brother. First, he freed himself using it, and then later to use it to free his brother and reconstitute his family. And that's different than the idea of messianic redemption.
Right, and I want to get into that because Spanish Catholicism wanted to keep the slaves in place.
That's right.
To be patient and wait for deliverance. African spirituality, which was being used by Monsanto and Placido, was used for power to act for freedom, to fight against enslavement.
That's right. That's right. And so really what you have, I argue, the book is the dichotomies between Spanish Catholicism. This was a slave theology specifically. Folks have to know that. You know, I know there's folks who ascribe to Protestantism and to Catholicism. I'm not here to tell anybody what religion they should practice. But I do think you have to know something about the history of it. So you're talking about a Spanish Catholic church that is producing slave catechisms, special books of instruction for enslaved people who are arguing that you should get your freedom in the by and by. It's about salvation. Whereas the African-inspired systems, the African-inspired spirituality, it was possible to acquire the power necessary or procure the power necessary to free oneself. So the kind of freedom that Monsanto and Placido were fighting for, you have to read the book to see the ways that they achieved it.
And they were collaborating too. So
they were collaborating, yeah.
They were collaborating. If you're just joining us, you're listening to KAZI Book Review on KAZI 88.7 FM. I'm Hopeton Hay. My guest is Matthew Pettway. And we're talking about his book, Cuban Literature in the Age of Black Insurrection, Monsanto, Placido, and Afro-Latino Religion. You have a PhD in Spanish, but you had to do a deep dive into religion for this book.
Absolutely.
And I guess you can't really study Spanish without Catholicism.
I don't think you can. I don't think you can. In my classes, I start with an introduction to literature of the Hispanophone world. I start with the African Muslims in Spain. But when we get to the medieval, later medieval period, we look at Spanish Catholic Church and the role that it played in establishing some of the early doctrines about what today we call race. The whole notion of purity of blood, you know, was established as a way of keeping Muslims, African Muslims, Arab Muslims of different colors, some of them black, some of them lighter hue, and Jewish persons away from political power in the 1470s in Iberia. We know that the papacy gave Portugal, even before Columbus, gave Portugal 1455 and slightly thereafter the authority to enslave Africans on the West African coast in order to get them to submit to Catholicism. So there's a long history of the two are intertwined in a way that's often uncomfortable for people, but I think it's important to acknowledge the history so that if a Catholic entity would choose or a Protestant entity would choose to, they can then do work, reparation type of work.
So let's get to the poetry of Placido.
Absolutely.
Placido. Thank you. Placido.
Placido. Placido. I'm going to actually talk about, since we were talking about the presence of African-inspired spirituality, I'm going to stay with that and talk now not about the West Central African traditions. So most Africans that were brought to the Western Hemisphere were brought from West Central Africa, what is today Angola, Gabon, parts of the Democratic Republic of Congo, formerly Zaire. But many of us, when we think about where might my people be from, we're thinking about Nigeria, Ghana, right? And right. So Nigeria, you had the Yoruba states, and they contributed to the Atlantic slave trade, along with the British and other slave traders. And what you have in Placido is a poem to the cult of the Virgin Mary, called itself A la Virgen del Rosario, or To the Virgin of Rosary. It's a sonnet, so I'll read this poem in its entirety, and then I'll talk a little bit about it, give a little background. So here's the English. Okay, here we are. Laud my brethren with the resounding chant to the bright morning star. Mystical rose, innocent amber color, laughter of heaven, terror of hell. You will contemplate the sun beneath her garments of the most vibrant pilgrim fire and a globe of divine virtue in each bead of her holy rosary. Her protection is a sign of jubilation. She assures you victory in life. And when the day of death arrives, as the King of Kings reads your past by the imminent refuge of Mary, she will open the doors of glory to you. So this poem is significant for a number of reasons. One, this is a poem that Plaso wrote, published in 1836, wrote and then published in 1836, to African religious brotherhoods in Cuba. And these brotherhoods would had a certain kind of autonomy. They were required by the Catholic Church to be Catholic, but they were not in effect fully and completely Catholic. They had not adopted the doctrine of the Catholic Church completely. So what the priest does in the late 18th century, Bishop Morel particularly, he comes to Havana and he says, wait a minute, why are these Africans on the feast days of the church? Why are they promoting their gods? Why are they parading images of their gods? And he goes into the cabildos and he gives them images of the Virgin Mary. And he gives them the rosary beads, right? Our Lady of the Rosary. And he says, you need to pray using these rosary beads and the Virgin Mary will lead you to God. Because of course he's assuming ignorance of the doctrine. And it may not have been a question necessarily of ignorance, but it was definitely a question of Africans insisting on religious agency. So what's significant about this is that within the cabildos, in order to be a part of one of these cabildos, which were really African, not African descended, not for, you know, lighter skinned African descendants typically, but people who were enslaved or free, recently freed in some cases, they had the swearing of oaths. You had a certain religious transculturation. So when Bishop Morel says, hey, you can't be out here essentially on the streets like that with your images, with your gods. And he requires them to use the image of the Virgin Mary and then provides them with an opportunity to associate certain representations of the Virgin Mary with understandings they had about African divine spirits, sometimes referred to as gods in the popular imagination. So when Beyonce's out there and Hold Up and her older album, and she's coming out of what appears to be a beautiful library, and you have these doors open and there's water flowing, almost like a menstruation, right? And she's draped in gold and she's glorious and brown and sensual but fierce. She is, in her own way, channeling the spirit of one Orisha known as Oshun. So now she's not even doing this in code anymore. And Black Parade, she just says, Oshun energy, right? Well, this particular image of the Virgin of the Virgin Mary, who was understood to be able to, it's so interesting because Paso says that she's of amber color. So in that way, he's letting the readership know that he's talking about a woman who is not white. He's talking about a woman of African descent. So at this time, in this society with these color politics that might look like New Orleans or Charleston or even Mobile in the 19th century, right? You have this whole notion that if you talk to a woman of African descent, you can't call her Black. You have to call her something other than Black. But what's also interesting here is that even though the Lady of the Rosary is a proselytizing symbol, she's there to bring them to Christ. These organizations were known for having their own religious identities. And the Virgin of the Rosary is equated with a Yoruba spirit called Dada, D-A-D-A, with an accent on the second A, Dada. And Dada was a crowned protector of children. So she's protecting, right, children. She's also the sister of a warrior spirit, Shango. So read another way, instead of leading them, she's giving them victory in life. Victory, she didn't say salvation, she said victory in life. And that can be read and as double entendre, right? Because the victory in life might be read as victory over the slave society, considering that Shango was a warrior spirit.
Well, let me jump in here real quick because I wanted to make sure
feel free
that we talked about the importance of Black intellectuals in fomenting resistance and rebellion during the slavery in Cuba. And specifically, you talk in a book about Plácido and Manzano conferring about rhetorical strategies and developing an anti-slavery aesthetic to disrupt mm-hmm. and subvert Spanish Catholic cultural hegemony. And they had to both, at times, and I can recall more from Plácido, write poetry, odes to the queen. So to stay in good stead with the queen, the Catholic Church.
That's right.
And then, of course, write poetry where if you knew how to read it, you knew it was sending you a message that the white Cubans didn't get. And if you could talk, you know, about 3 or 4 minutes about that.
Sure, absolutely. Well, one of the things that were most interesting to me that I developed in the book that I couldn't develop as a graduate student was more fully the relationship between these two men. And so they meet around 1839. We know that they became close friends. We know that they drink together. We know that they share social space together. And we know that they exchange manuscripts of their poetry. And the fact that they exchanged manuscripts of their poetry and they talked about what they were writing about, this is what Plácido argues. So when they're both on trial for conspiring against the Spanish colonial state, Plácido's pushing Manzano, and Manzano's trying to pull away. And he's saying, well, actually, you know, Plácido and I, we really just was drinking and talking about women. Literally, that's what he says. That's how I knew the brother wasn't telling the truth. Because they were both too sophisticated to only be doing that. Sure, that was part of it, but that's not all that they were doing. And I should say this. The other thing to understand about this, the accusations, is the 1844 movement, known as the Ladder Conspiracy, was said to be essentially a conspiracy against the white population, a conspiracy to exterminate the white population. So this notion of this fear that formerly enslaved people or enslaved people would rise up and wipe out their enemy, which is still with us, has its origin long before the 21st century or the 20th century. So because they exchange manuscripts with one another, and I haven't fallen upon or come upon any of those manuscripts, it's hard to know which poems they may have actually written in unison or where they may have shared ideas. But in terms of an anti-slavery aesthetic in their work, more broadly, we know that they both write about the Virgin Mary and Catholic saints, but in the interest of Black freedom. So the Virgin Mary and the Catholic saints can be found in other examples of 19th century Cuban literature. You can find it in these abolitionist novels or reformist novels, as I like to refer to them, but they don't show up in a way in which their Black people are using them, invoking them to free themselves. You also have the Greco-Roman deities. Like I said, Mars, the god of wars, and Plácido's work. You have in Manzano, Venus appears in one of his poems, and he tells her, you shouldn't be on the plantation with me. This is a horrible place. And she says, shut up, fool, literally. Calla, necio. She said, I've come here for you. I've come here for you. So she's a maternal figure in that poem, something like an orisha. And then Plácido has in another poem, he has Cuba showing up as a woman, who a poem called The Prophecy from Cuba to Spain that I think listeners would really like, where she shows up as a woman crowned with lemon and orange blossoms. And the word for the lemon and orange blossoms is the word with an Arabic etymology, which suggests that those flowers are from the south of Spain, tied to the history of the south of Spain, which was where you had the African and Muslims ruling for many centuries. And she looks at Spain directly, and she condemns Spain. She condemns actually not Spain, but the Queen of Spain in this poem, telling her that you are a slave on the throne, but never a king. This is what she says to the Queen of Spain. And then finally, the other thing you find in their work is that African spirituality is not ridiculed, but it's a source of power. It's a source of power.
I want to get back to the pigmentocracy, because it was a really sophisticated way, as you talk about in your book, to keep people of African descent in conflict with each other. And so on the one hand, you have the people who have a substantial amount of European blood, you know, mm-hmm. trying to be more and more white, and the white Cubans knowing that if we give benefits to those who are closer to white, and if we have this caste system where you're ranked socially and privileged, the lighter skinned you are, the more European blood you have, the higher you mm-hmm. are in that caste system, fomenting conflict to keep from people of African descent coming together to fight slavery. So talk about that in Cuba. And Cuba, correct me if I'm wrong, incredibly rich, sugar. Was it the most profitable Spanish colony because of the sugar trade?
It did become the most profitable Spanish colony. Cuba didn't begin that way. In the early centuries, Cuba was, I won't call it a backwater. Some historians like David Wheat have questioned that, whether or not it's a backwater, but it wasn't an economic powerhouse for the Spanish crown until the Haitian Revolution. So when the Haitians, when Africans destroy the sugar plantations in Saint-Domingue, and they transform Saint-Domingue into a black republic, the Cubans white Cubans seize upon this as an opportunity, and they began to build their plantation system. And there's an increase, even before the Cubans are thinking this way, there's an increase in the population of Africans on the island because of the British siege of Havana back in the 1860s. And after that, of course, you have the Haitian Revolution in 1791. And white Cubans, aristocrats, seize upon the opportunity. But when they transform the island into a sugar-producing island, they do so rapidly that the demographic shift on the island away from a white majority, or at least what the census tells us was at one point a white majority, to a population of African descent that was burgeoning. And the population was so large, most people who were enslaved were African-born, most people in plantations who were enslaved were African, overwhelmingly, like more than 90% were African-born. But people weren't living very long lives because they were being worked so hard. So some estimates say under a decade, people come from the continent under a decade. What the Spanish do is the Spanish have a series of laws in place that one in particular that talks about the ways in which not a marital union, but sex between, it was almost always thought to be a white man and a woman of African descent would produce a mulatto child, a child that was not really completely black or completely white. And race was thought to be a biological fact. Biological reality. So they're trying to get down to, you know, percentages. So they'll say this person is a fourth African, or this person's half African. This person is African but born in the Americas, so he's a Creole, a criollo, et cetera, et cetera. So while in the United States, I'll say this kind of has to help out in terms of clarity, while the United States, we had since the 19th century this black-white dichotomy, Cuba had a pyramid system that was based on the color of the skin, the relative lightness of the skin, the shape and slope of the nose, as well as the width of the nose, how thick the lips were, and especially the hair. Hair was exceptionally important. So there's even a word in Cuban Spanish today for someone who in complexion would be considered white, like placid, white in appearance, right? But you look at the hair, and the hair is like my hair. It's woolly. It's a more typically West African or more typically African. And that person is called Habao. So that all these different terms came to exist. But ultimately, in spite of that, the dichotomy between African and non-African or black and white didn't really disappear. In fact, if you want, I can read a really short poem that Plácido wrote. His own satire.
Please do.
Yeah. This is, I want to say, to set it up a little bit for the audience. What's ironic is that, or not ironic, but significant for us, that Plácido had the opportunity to disassociate from the African community, because he wasn't first generation Cuban. We think he was second generation. We believe that to be the case for both. But he didn't do that. He was raised by his black grandmother, who some sources say was an enslaved person. formerly enslaved person, excuse me, in Havana. And he went to Carnival, and he was at other African cultural festivities. So he, as a person who was of lighter hue, he would have thought to associate with the power structure, particularly with the pigmentocracy or the colorism. He published a poem called "If Arsino Says to Everyone," "Si a todos Arsino Dices," just two stanzas. If Arsino says to everyone that they are from the lower caste, when they possess guinea in their hair and in their nostrils, Arsino, you should confess, it's proven nonsense to throw stones at your neighbor when the roof is made of glass. It is proven nonsense to throw stones at your neighbor when the roof is made of glass. And he points to two things there. He talks about the lower caste, right? Indicating the fact that according to one's color, one's racial identity was identified. And with racial identity, typically class. But then also he says the hair and the nostrils. Those are the two things that most spoke to racial identity. And by using the word Guinea was another word for Africa, like Ethiopia.
So to what degree the pigmentocracy, how did it affect the resistance? So we have Monsanto, who was he half black, half African?
No, Monsanto was considered, he was considered mulatto, presumably because his father was considered mulatto. That may have been a reference to his skin color. We don't have any, there's no portraiture of Monsanto, of course, but so we don't know exactly how the brother looked. But we do know that he was considered mulatto, but his mother was black. His father was considered mulatto.
Okay.
And they were enslaved house servants. But Palacio is believed to have been lighter in skin. And we do have descriptions of Palacio, which I do go over in the book. And he was of lighter hue. He was of lighter hue. Monsanto would not have been described as white in appearance at birth. That much we can say pretty
clearly. Placido would be. So talk about how this intraracial colorism mm-hmm. affected the resistance in Cuba during the time of Placido and Monsanto.
Okay. Well, I will start with the fact that the Spanish government, we know that race is a concept. Many of us argue that began in Iberia in the 15th century. And this tied to this notion of blood. But initially, it's Muslim blood and Jewish blood. That idea changes. The idea that religion essentially ceases to be the primary marker of religious difference. I'm sorry, primary marker of racial difference when you have the conquest of the Americas by Cortes and Pizarro. You know, Columbus starting in 1493, really, and not arriving in 1493, but really starting in 1493 with his hostilities against the indigenous populations. So the old Catholics arrive in the New World, quote unquote, supposedly New World, although it was already here, right, as the conquerors. And they were typically European, phenotypically European. And so they were able to set up a new social system in the Americas that would be based on color. And this is why, you know, these Mexican casta paintings that were done in the early colonial period to set up new racial categories. Well, in places like Cuba, to get to answer your question about the 1844 anti-slavery movement, in places like Cuba, you essentially had an indigenous population that had been decimated. It had been decimated in the 1500s, the 16th century, by the Spanish. And so overwhelmingly, you're really dealing with a black-white divide, an African-European divide. With the 1844 movement, what the record says, the historical record says, is that the historical record claims that the movement was organized by the British, or that the British were at the helm, and that they had an agent who was considered to be a very smart mulatto, who we believe was Haitian, whose name is Luis Guigaut, G-I-G-A-U-T, or in Spanish, G-I-G-O with an accent on the O, he go, who proselytized. The word is seduced, that's the word they use. The Spanish use the word seduced. There's a psychosexual undertone to this entire conspiracy. And he seduced the mulattoes like Placido, had them swear an oath, and then Placido is said to have administered oaths to his brethren, right? Because he's already tied into these initiation societies one way or another, even though he's not really supposed to be close to them culturally, because he's supposed to be a mulatto, supposed to be closer to white. So the British played a role, probably not as large a role as the Spanish claimed. But we do know that African descendants, free African descendants and some free blacks organized. But in the process of organizing, there was some difference of opinion about what should ultimately happen. Not so much about whether or not Cuba should become independent, but there was some debate about whether or not, I'll put it like this. There's one moment in the record where Plaso says he's defending people of African descent the entire time with regard to the conspiracy. He's saying, they were innocent. He says they were chess pieces. They were pawns in the hands of far more powerful interests, i.e. white aristocratic interests. And he critiques the white aristocracy, which is a slaveholding aristocracy, vehemently, right? He really comes for them. He goes for the jugular. But there's one moment towards the end where he's trying to save his life. He said, but you know, there were some folks that wanted to kill all white folks on the island. And that was, and he refers to one of his erstwhile conspirators. And he said, they wanted to kill anyone that wasn't white, anyone that wasn't white. And in that moment, he seems to imply that there was some debate even between African descendants that were considered black and African descendants that were considered mulatto, which I know is a derogatory term now, or mixed race people, right? That there was some debate amongst them. What's difficult sometimes for us to understand as modern African Americans is that some of these mixed race people also were slaveholders themselves.
It's and not so, difficult to understand that if you're
well, you know about Louisiana's history, the coasts.
No, but, I have friends whose family owned slaves way back okay. when, who are Creole.
I do too. I have one friend like that, yeah. And so there were some debates amongst them about that. And it seems that that was one of the factors that brought about the collapse of the movement internally. They didn't completely cohere, even though there were a serious string of anti-slavery uprisings on plantations, because of course African people enslaved on plantations had their own ideas. And Plaza was moving from city to city with messages. And we know that his poetry, some poems in particular, one poem called Havana Liberty or Habaneros Libertad, Habaneros Libertad, you can just hear it, right? Like a mantra, that these poems were being, not only were they being recited, but the manuscripts were being circulated.
So let me ask you to talk about, like today, people go to social media, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, and it sort of inspires and angers them. That's sort of the way this information today gets out to people about issues of resistance and rebellion, anti-fascism. Talk about the importance of poetry, the role of poetry in the 1830s and the 1840s in Cuba, how important it was in inspiring resistance and rebellion.
Well, poetry played an extraordinarily important role because the majority of the population was non-literate. You know, I'm not only talking about people of African descent whose ancestors in many cases would have had alternative writing systems like the alternative writing system in Old Calabar, the NCBD writing system that I make a brief reference to in the book. So African societies, modern African societies were not without writing systems, but these were parts of initiation societies. They were not always necessarily, they weren't necessarily widespread in use. But I'm not just talking about people of African descent who didn't read and write Spanish. I'm talking about white folk, rural white folk that didn't read and write Spanish, you know, their own language. So if you're gonna get a message to people, you're gonna get that message orally. And you're going to use metaphors, you're going to use myth, and you're going to refer to established belief structures. By that, I'm talking about their understandings, their beliefs regarding religion and regarding spirituality. Because these rural white folk from Iberia, they also believed in the power of, in coercive power. They also believed in brujeria or coercive power. They also believed, ooh, I had a dream. I've got to do something about that. They were also many times problematic for the Catholic Church. Catholic priests were like, what are you talking about? We haven't approved that. We don't know that's a miracle. We haven't sanctioned that as a miracle. They would actually go around sanctioning what was a miracle and what wasn't. So this was a very rich oral culture that were oral cultures, really in plural, that were coming into one space in Cuba. You had the Bakongo from West Central Africa that I believe Manzano was referencing in a dream from my second brother, and Placido, the Yoruba speaking cultures, several cultures, but Yoruba speaking cultures is a lingua franca in what is now Nigeria, bringing in, you know, their references. And then you have the Spanish, you know, with their belief systems and their poems called the Decima, these really short poems that were, I believe, 10 lines of verse. Yeah, 10 lines of verse, each line being 8 syllables. So that Decima in particular, right, is a format that people remembered, and they would spit verse like a rapper, right? They would extemporize. And so that's how you got messages. In fact, the Catholic Church used the Decima to spread the gospel according to the Bible and according to their own interpretation of the Bible. They used the Decima because they couldn't sit people down and say, hey, read this. The catechism itself, it relies on call and response. You know, you ask, you know, how many gods are there? Hay un solo Dios. There's only one God. And so poetry played an extraordinarily important role. And so in spite of the censorship of written material, all written material was censored. You know, this is not Boston, Massachusetts in the colonial period, right? This is Havana in the colonial period. There's no freedom of the press, right? Or no pretensions to freedom of the press. And so even though you couldn't make any references against the Queen of Spain, you couldn't condemn the Catholic Church or attack the Catholic Church, and there are a series of other prohibitions, you couldn't really stop people from saying what they were going to say. And you certainly could not control the empire of their minds. And that's why the poetry was so powerful.
I want to go back to Manzano, and specifically the writing of his autobiography. As you explained earlier, the anti-slavery element wanted him to write the autobiography because they basically feared that Cuba was becoming too black.
That's right. That's right.
But when he wrote it, he lost control of it, mm-hmm. lost agency. Mm-hmm. Yep. Mm-hmm. A poem, his first poem wasn't included. And was it released in Europe and not released in Cuba, right?
That's right. It's released in Europe. It's published in England in 1840. So his slave narrative is so incredibly important for Afro-Latin American studies. And I think just whether you've read a lot about Latin America or not, you could pick up that book and learn something about slavery in Cuba. It's available in English translation, a modernized English translation on Amazon. But I think what's so significant about it is that it's requested by Domingo del Monte, because Domingo del Monte, a slaveholder and a prominent humanist, is really looking to reduce the number of Black people on the island. And so he wants testimonial literature, more so than ethnography or autoethnography. He really wants testimonial literature so that he can be taken to the anti-slavery conventions and Spain can be condemned, but he had to keep his hands off of it. Manzano himself doesn't even sign it, but we know that it's from Manzano based upon what it says and the ways in which it lines up with other historical documentation. I've seen it, and thankfully, it's at the National Library in Havana, in case you got anybody out there who's interested in that. But now it's online. So, you know, if someone wants to know where it is, they can just email me. I can tell them. So he does lose control over it. He writes it between 1834 and 1835 or 1836. I think it might be 1836 when he finishes it. Not entirely clear. And he's telling the story of his life. He's a bit uncomfortable with some of the more embarrassing details, more shameful details of what was done to him. It is taken from Manzano, and William Luis does some really good work on this, a scholar named William Luis. Then it's put in the hands of a member of Del Monte's literary salon, and they standardize the Spanish, make some changes to it, and then it's sent to Irish abolitionist, who's a medical doctor named Richard Robert Madden, very prominent and was a true abolitionist. And he translates it into English. When he translates it into English, he takes Manzano's surname off. So it just says Juan Francisco, and then it's dot, dot, there's an ellipsis. He's like, okay. But there was no one else in Cuba producing that kind of literature at the time. So, you know, had it fallen into the hands of the Spanish, they would have known who it was. So really with no reason, no legitimate reason. He rearranges the text. When Manzano talks about, you know, his reverence for the saints, how he reveres the saints who have been transculturated with African divine spirits, right? Like Dada, with the Virgin of the Rosary, Shango's warrior sister, like, right, with the Virgin of the Rosary, just like that. When he talks about that, Richard Robert Madden got rid of that because he evidently didn't want there to be any examples of Catholic superstition or worse, right? So it's published in England, and then 1841 and 1842, Madden uses it at the anti-slavery conventions. Some work is being done on that now about the significance of that work at the anti-slavery conventions in London and Paris. I mentioned it briefly in the book, but I don't go into detail.
So what do you think today that the resistance, the people fighting against white supremacy, what do you think today you would say that they could get from the poetry and the autobiography of Manzano and Plácido?
Mm-hmm. That's a great question. I think number one, we have to fight like hell because we don't know what's coming, what's coming down the pike. It was unexpected 4 years ago that such a regime could come to power in the United States and that it would have such strong fascist overtones, that propaganda would be used in such a belligerent way, that there could even be connections between the state, and I'm talking about the current regime and a foreign government, which have not fully been explored or understood. It's a very, very dangerous moment. The dangers of the notion, the idea of a white ethno state. Now, from one standpoint, for African Americans, like, well, what was the South, right? In the era of Jim Crow, right? But the notion of that being a national policy in an unapologetic way, it's what some people want. So I don't talk about this a lot, but I do have a role as an intellectual, and I do have to say this is a very dangerous moment. Voting for one candidate who's in opposition to the current regime is not enough. There'll be all kinds of work we'll have to do. My work is largely in education. When I think about what Manzano and Plácido have bequeathed us, what they've left us with, what our inheritance is a keen understanding. I think we have to look to myth and to religion as a way of speaking to people's hearts and minds at the same time. You have to win people's hearts and minds at the same time, especially with our own people. It's not enough, I think, oftentimes to bring an intellectual argument because our intellectual traditions require the heart and the mind to be brought together. You know, people have to be able to feel what you're talking about. Can you feel me? I think that's very important. And Manzano and Plácido were masters of using symbols. They were masters of that. Now they went beyond myth because they're also using African spiritual systems. But I think we need to command that. I don't think you can throw religion out, even if you have a critique of religion, because most people are going to be more responsive to that than they are going to be to a strictly, you know, intellectual argument. So there has to, if you find that people are responsive to that, there has to be a way to use it to convince them. I think the other thing is, intra-racial unity. This is where they failed, right? It's where Manzano and Plácido's movement failed. Manzano, as far as we can tell, we don't know if he swore the oath that Plácido administered, but if he did, he may have abjured the oath, or he may have reneged. You know, it appears that he may have reneged because he was present for some of those meetings with Luis Guigot, with this sharp Haitian brother, right? So unity, and I think unity should not be confused with homogeneity. So you're going to have people who are Black Muslims. You're going to have people who are Black Marxists, communists, and socialists who maybe don't go as far as the communists in terms of their viewpoints. You're going to have folks who are inveterate Christians, right? And the question is, where can you find a common belief system? if we're talking about the African-American community or Black people in the United States more broadly, including Africans, Afro-Caribbeans, Afro-Latinx people, then the question becomes, where are your common places, right? One of the things that Malcolm X does so brilliantly after coming back from Mecca is he say, hey, I'm going to have two organizations, and one of the organizations is going to be non-religious, because I do want Black Christians to be in solidarity with me, and I with them, and I'm not going to put religion in the way. So we can use it as a tool, but we can't allow it to divide us. And then the last thing I would say is solidarity across the racial ethnic groups, and this I think is perhaps even more difficult than the solidarity among peoples of African descent, Africans, Afro-Latin Americans, or Afro-Latinx Africans, African-Americans, Afro-Caribbeans. The solidarity beyond, you know, with Latinx people who are not of African descent, with indigenous people, that takes more work. And it takes honest conversations, you know. If people are interested, it may take conversations about how populations have sometimes been competitors, before you can sit down at the table and say, well, we both have the same labor needs, or we need similar labor protections, or we need our voting rights protected, right? So those are the things that I would suggest. None of it's easy, but I think the book gives you the example of they were masters of the use of mythos and symbols, and they drew upon religion as a source of knowledge, but we have to be careful that doesn't divide us as people of African descent in the U.S.
So your book is clearly across disciplines, clearly. And I believe this was based in part on your dissertation, right?
That's right.
So, but what I like is it's this broad sort of topic. It's not as narrow as I've seen a lot of dissertations that are incredibly narrow. I got a friend who's got his PhD in journalism and communications, where mm-hmm. it's just so narrowly focused, but yet your book speaks broadly. You know, you're dealing with, you know, Black intellectuals in Cuba in, you know, the 1830s, but you're dealing with inspired poetry. You're dealing with the pigmentocracy. You're dealing with, you know, British Caribbean nations where the slaves are being free. I mean, it's just such a broad mm-hmm. topic, which makes it more interesting for me. So when you were writing your dissertation and then moving over to the book, were you thinking that I don't want this to be too narrow? Because it's not, as a reader, it is not. It is like, wow,
The dissertation of the book, are you thinking about the dissertation of the book? So different.
Of course, the dissertation, of course, you got to do whatever is required to get that dissertation.
That's right.
But when you wrote the book, You wrote the book in a manner that I think has broad appeal. So
I really appreciate that. I did want it to have broad appeal. I wanted to make sure, I wanted to write something from the standpoint of what I do for a living as a professor. I wanted to write something that I would have loved to have read when I was a graduate student. I wanted to write something that didn't exist at the time. I wanted to write something that had never been written before. So I wanted to break new ground. I didn't want to stand in anyone's shadow. And at the same time, I was hopeful. I said, well, I think this story is compelling. And I had a friend named Randall Jokes who said, you need to really tell the story. He's a historian at the University of Kansas. You need to really tell the story.
You know where Randall's from, right?
Yeah.
From New Orleans, then Chicago.
That's right.
New Orleans first.
That's right. And now he's in Michigan. Well, he was in Michigan, Grand Rapids. But yeah, that's right. That's right. But I say that because I wanted to reach a broader public. And I thought if I tell the story of these poets, their stories are so compelling, it might even be made into a movie. I mean, it's that compelling. It could be a documentary or even a movie. And I said, people may not be interested in reading all of their poetry, but there may be two or three sonnets or a decima here or there, or the slave narrative that'll speak to them, and they can use that. That's ancestor work.
Do you see the tie between, you're talking about the African spirit, Yoruba, et cetera, and Lovecraft Country?
Oh my goodness.
It's there.
I've been watching that. I don't watch too much TV, but I'm watching that.
It's there. I mean, there's this whole cosmos of African spirits that are dealt with, like we said, in the Caribbean,
mm-hmm.
but not dealt with by African Americans. Mm-hmm. That it's been mm-hmm. almost wiped out. And even when you read the history of Christianity and understanding to some degree that they adopted some of the pagan aspects, paganism was sort of pulled into mm-hmm. it a little bit to bring them on board. But here in this country, with regards to making the African spirits demonic, and you know, the Catholic Church and the slaveholders seeing it as, if we allow this in, then this will destabilize slavery. And of course, mm-hmm. The slaves found ways to slip it in without them knowing this. But I look mm-hmm. here once again, I want to come back to the United States of America. You really don't see it anywhere near as much as you see that influence in Cuba and in the Caribbean.
I think some of it may have to do with numbers. The population of people of African descent, most, this would have been a nice thing to say at the beginning, but over 90% of the Africans brought to the Western Hemisphere against their will were brought to the Caribbean and Latin America, not North America. So you got a much smaller percentage of Africans that were brought to North America. And also in the United States, enslaved people were able to reproduce, sexually reproduce more adequately, more easily. In Latin America and the Caribbean, people really were dying. And one estimate says less than 10 years, a lot of people were living. And so you had a constant influx. Slaveholders would just buy more people. They would just buy more men, women and children, especially men and boys. Early on in Cuba, there was a de-emphasis on buying women, and the church made a corrective on that because they wanted the Catholic Church wanted there to be families. It was possible for enslaved people to get married there. At least on paper, it was possible. But at the end of the day, some people argue that you can find some semblance of African-inspired spirituality in Black Christianity. And like in some of the, down here, for example, the Bottle Trees are present in Mobile. I also seen them in Charleston, and you'll find them other parts of the U.S. South. And there, Paris Thompson says that they are tied to West Central African spirituality. But the population was much larger in the Caribbean and Latin America. And people would die and new people were being brought in. And I think the existence of those confraternities, those religious brotherhoods that I talked about at the onset of our conversation, when I spoke about Palacios' poem to the Virgin of the Rosary, or that I argue is also the Yoruba spirit Dada, those also played a very significant role. You could have your own religious organizations, then you could do things behind closed door. You could swear oaths that no one's going to know about. And no one's going to know about. I mean, the church tried to play some type of role in administering them, but they weren't able to control them.
Well, we do have the Prince Hall Masons.
We do. We do. I'm not familiar enough with their religious beliefs. I don't know enough about them to speak, but these organizations were all over. I mean, Brazil had these organizations. They were co-ed. They elected their own kings and queens. They reflected a knowledge of African history. For example, one could be elected the king of the Congo in a Congo brotherhood. So they're still using the word Congo, even if they were tied to St. Anthony. San Antonio, right? The spirit that Manzano transculturates with the spirit of the crossroads, or Legua in the book. So I think that there were some things in place that made it easier for people of African descent to hold on. And Catholicism in some way lent itself to that camouflage with this emphasis on intermediaries like the Virgin Mary and Catholic saints.
Well, this has been a great discussion. Matthew Petway, author of Cuban Literature in the Age of Black Insurrection, Manzano, Plácido, and Afro-Latino Religion. Thanks for being a guest on KZL Book Review.
Thank you. Thank you for having me, Hope Tan.
Thanks for listening to this podcast edition of KAZI Book Review. Be sure to like my Facebook page entitled KAZI Book Review. And my Twitter handle is at KAZIBooks. And my Instagram handle is KAZI_book_review. Have a great day.